We're going to be looking at paper 16. I don't know, Kumar, if this is your first time with the Interpretations Committee or if you were here at your previous incarnation or not.
Yes, I was.
You were, so that means you do not have to be nice to Kumar.
Thank you, Wayne.
Okay, paper 16, Wanhee.
Yes, paper 16 relates to accounting for repo transactions. And we have two issues. Issue one is whether three transactions should be aggregated as one single transaction or accounted for separately. Issue two is how the indicators in paragraph implementation guidance 3.6 of IS 39 should be applied when considering issue one. Let me briefly summarize the basic fact patterns of the three transactions. There are two parties, entity alpha and entity beta, that entered into the three transactions. Transaction one is a bond purchase deal. Entity alpha purchases a bond from entity beta. Transaction two is an interest rate swap that starts on the same day as the purchase date of transaction one and has the same maturity date as the bond. In this interest rate swap deal, entity alpha pays a fixed rate of interest equal to the fixed coupon rate of the purchased bond in transaction one and receives a variable rate of interest. In transaction three, entity alpha enters into a repurchase agreement with entity beta, in which entity alpha sells the same bond in transaction one on the same day it purchases the bond and agrees to buy back the bond at the maturity date of the bond. Transaction 3 also has provisions regarding a credit event. Before addressing the issue of whether the transactions should be aggregated or not, I think that we need to understand what the accounting would be like if the transactions were to be accounted for separately. This is because this understanding would be helpful to get a picture of this complicated structure of the deal. So that's why we performed an analysis of whether transaction 1 and 3 meet the derecognition criteria, which you can see in analysis 3 and analysis 4 of this paper. And as you can see, there could be different accounting treatments depending on facts and circumstances. With having this understanding that accounting treatment can vary if the transactions were to be accounted for separately, we can think about whether the transactions should be aggregated or not. To analyze that, our initial examination was to see whether the three transactions have equivalent net cash flows to those of a derivative. This is because if the transactions were to be aggregated as a single derivative, those transactions should have the same profile as a derivative. And we found that the net cash flows of the transactions in aggregate are similar to those of a credit default swap. However, we note that the facts alone does not mean that the transactions should be aggregated. We noted that the current standards provide guidance on whether non-derivative transactions should be aggregated as a single derivative. The guidance includes paragraph IG B.6 and C.6 of IS 39 and application guidance paragraph 39 of IS 32. In our view, these paragraphs basically imply two things. First, an assessment can vary depending on facts and circumstances of the transactions. And second, an assessment would require a considerable level of judgment. For example, one of the indicators set out in paragraph IGP.6 of I-39 is whether the transactions are entered into in contemplation of one another. Consequently, we think that we cannot determine whether the transactions should be aggregated or not, simply on the basis of the limited information provided in the submission. We think that a full understanding of the facts and circumstances surrounding the transactions is required. We also looked at issue two, which is how the indicators set out in paragraph IGP.6 of IS 39 should be applied when addressing issue one. We think that the purpose of the indicators is to provide broad guidance on assessing whether non-derivative transactions in substance meet the definition of a derivative. In other words, this paragraph IGP.6 sets out indicators to consider, but those indicators in themselves are not conclusive. We therefore think that we cannot give definitive answers to each of the submitters' questions in issue 2 as well. On the basis of our analysis for issue 1 and issue 2, we recommend that the Interpretation Committee should not take the issues onto its agenda.
A word of introduction. This is a question that obviously focuses on a specific deal. And usually we would resist when somebody makes that kind of a submission to us. The submitter in this case thought it was particularly important that the committee discuss this. And out of respect for them, we have brought it to you. I think when he has appropriately focused our attention on whether or not the indicators are definitive, especially the last one that essentially says you need to be inside the mind of the people who put the thing together, that they did it, pardon the expression, with malice aforethought, that they specifically structured it, and we do not have that information, so we obviously cannot judge that. But I think he's appropriately focused our attention not on the details of this particular transaction, but on the role of the indicators. Would that be a fair characterization, Wendy? Okay. With that, comments, reactions, discussions?
Wendy, may I?
Yes, certainly, Luca.
First of all, I would like to make my compliments to the staff because the topic is very complicated and the paper is very thoughtful and very useful to understand where we are and where we are going. I agree with what you have said, that we should consider it what is written in the standards rather than the specific case. And with reference to this, I have some different opinion with respect to what staff has indicated, especially for 2 points. Implementation guidance B6, I agree, that requires for its application a certain level of judgment, but my view of the level of judgment is probably not so wide as the one presented by the staff. Especially there are 2 points that in my opinion are important. The first one is the counterparty. B6 is very clear indicated that you need to have the same counterparty in order to try to represent more transactions as only one single transaction. If I try to look at the example presented, consider it also another counterparty. For instance, the transaction one is the acquisition of a bond from company C, not company beta. I think that we will reach a very different conclusion, and probably I will escape from the idea to have and to recognize all the transactions as a single transaction. So, my personal view is that the counterparty is not an indicator, but is a rule, and you necessarily need to have the same counterparty or different counterparties that are linked at times in time the same structure of the contract. The second point is the last part of the paragraph B6, in which it's clear that you have to verify if you are doing several transactions only with the aim to reflect the effect of a single transaction. I agree that probably we do not have all the items, all the elements to verify this in the specific case presented, but one thing is quite strange in this case, because if there is a credit event, company, there are 2 effects. The first one, the repo is closed, and there is the option for company B to sell back not the same bond, but the cheapest bond. And the other fact is that company beta could maintain in existence the swap made in the second transaction. This I'd like right in my mind that I'm not replying exactly the same effect of the normal credit default swap. So I think that also this element, so the fact that you necessarily need to have exactly the same effect of what you would have with a single transaction is not an indicator, but is a principle that is necessary to be respected in order to have the recognition as a single transaction.
Okay, so I'm not sure what I take of your comments. Would you say then, I thought I heard you say, let me be sure that I understood, that because there isn't a single counterparty, you would say this cannot be aggregated.
Yes.
On the other hand, you would say that because the cash flows are the same as would exist in a credit default swap, that it should be aggregated. So are you, which of those am I missing?
No. I said exactly the first one, that
okay.
In my opinion, B6 requires that you have the same counterparty. The second item that I say is that considering that if there is a credit event, company beta would have the possibility to maintain in existence the swap. There is the second transaction, the interest rate swap. It means, in my opinion, that there are other cash flows that are different from those that
okay.
have been reached in a more simple transaction relating to a credit default swap. This presence of the interest rate swaps, in my opinion, is relevant in order to verify the last bullet point of paragraph B6 that asks you to verify, in order to make the aggregation, that the several transactions produce exactly the same effect of a single transaction. In this case, you will not have the same effect of a single transaction, because in the case of a credit event, you will have the possibility to sell back a cheapest bond, not the same bond, and at the same time to maintain in existence an interest rate swap that is not, at this point, something more linked with the credit default swap.
It's been pointed out to me that is fairly common in a lot of credit default swaps. So, Andrew and then Scott.
Well, I completely agree that this committee cannot and should not opine on direct accounting for this particular transaction. I also think it's the staff's analysis in terms of how it positions the guidance in IGB6 has, I think, pretty much got it right. So I don't think we can say that is definitive, partly because that's accompanying guidance. It's not part of IAS 39, so it can't be definitive for that simple reason. But also clearly some of these indicators, particularly the fourth one, economic need or substantive business purpose, requires judgment and is very dependent on detailed facts and circumstances. All that said, and without opining on the transaction, I have to say this looks an awful lot like a derivative to me. A total return swap, perhaps. It seems to be, I don't quite understand the point about different counterparties. Maybe that the issue of the bond might be a different party, but we're talking about three transactions between entities Alpha and Beta, buying the bond, selling the bond back, subject to a repo and an interest rate swap combined. So it did look like a derivative, and I wouldn't want to finalise an agenda decision that diminishes the role of B6, whilst acknowledging that it's not definitive and requires judgment. The other part of the analysis goes down, is about recognition and derecognition. I felt that the decision goes into too much detail on that point. It isn't the primary objective of the submission. I'm not sure that all of, we don't have enough facts and circumstances, I'm not sure all of these outcomes are actually very likely at least. I'm also not sure if you have three transactions in the same asset at the same time, which of those transactions do you consider as part of the derecognition analysis? It kind of considers transaction one and transaction three independently. I'm not sure our circumstances are totally clear, but are quite clearly circumstances where you would consider two contracts together as part of the derecognition analysis, which this paper doesn't actually do. So I don't think we need to go into this detail on the different scenarios on the derecognition analysis, and I don't think we should.
I think several of us had the same view, but as Juan he has said, he found it helpful to take that path and go down it. And having found it helpful, he thought we might too. So, Scott?
Well, certainly I don't think that we should that we should try to address this. With respect to B6, I mean, certainly your indicators, none of them are rules. Nothing in IG is a rule, I guess. Not even clear whether anything in the IG is a principle that we always have to follow, since it's just IG. Be very hard for us to make a decision when the only guidance is in the IG section anyways. But moreover, if we start going down the path of providing guidance on every scheme like this, we'll be doing it forever. I've been sat in on EITF meetings for many years. Even the EITF wouldn't answer this question. It's too detailed. This is awfully difficult. And to me, whenever you get a situation like this, the first question is the business purpose. Why? Yeah. Why have you done this? And there's no indication in any of these materials of why. I don't think it's even possible to analyze the transaction without having that as the starting point. I can tell you that these transactions do not appear to be transactions that would have accidentally occurred at the same time. Kind of like leases do not accidentally wind up with the cash flows equaling 89.9% of the fair value when the rule is 90%. I don't think these three transactions came together by happenstance. So I start to worry about whether they are substantively separate transactions in the first place, and I think that's basically what B6 is telling us, is to worry about such things. So I think it's appropriate to worry about it. I agree with others on the derecognition issue. I mean, transaction three is the repo. A repo is actually two transactions, but we look at those together for derecognition purposes. I'm not sure why we wouldn't look at one and three together as well for derecognition purposes. So I think we need to scale back all of that. And the agenda decision I just thought was too long. In general, put too much into this specific transaction, as if we actually had something to say about this transaction other than, no, we can't answer this kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think we really need to scale back the agenda decision in total and just say, we know that this requires judgment. There's some guidance in B6 that could be helpful. Derecognition is complicated as well. There's guidance in these paragraphs to refer to. And we decided that this was way too detailed for us to try to take on.
Tony, was your light on when I reset the machine?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead then, please.
In very much the same place, I agree this is something that the committee shouldn't address. I think that B6 is looking to get to the substance of the transaction, and therefore it provides you with some indicators, and so any individual indicator isn't going to be determinative by itself whether it's there or it's not. It says look at the substance, and like others, I think the level of detail in here suggests to me that or it might suggest to me, if I hadn't been sat around this table, that we had tried to come to an answer. And I'd be much more comfortable if we chopped out the detail and said the guidance in the standard is there. It requires judgment. We're not taking it onto the agenda.
you just volunteered for the drafting committee. Reinhardt? my view is the same as what Tony just enunciated. I mean, I found the staff paper helpful in terms of the analysis, but when it comes to the agenda decision, given that the submitted did not specifically talk about what the accounting is if they would not be aggregated, I didn't think the agenda decision needs to go into that aspect of it, which I think would help shorten the decision, focus on defense of the facts and circumstances, and B6, the factors are indicative. Charlotte?
I basically agree with what most people have said. I don't think it's taken onto the agenda. I would point out that I wouldn't think of this as a single one-off transaction. It is a relatively common structured transaction, just so that people are aware. I do think there is a lot of divergence in the market about how people treat B6. Is it different than, for example, talking about, you know, whether people think each one is determinative, like if you have a different counterparty or you're automatically excluded from B6, if it's not quite contemporaneous, where are you? You know, if there's a slightly different risk, where are you? And all of those factors are discussed, and people, the firms have widely different views, individuals in the firm have different views, and it's not necessarily facts and circumstances of the trade specific, it's to do with how people apply B6. And I also, so I think, for example, in the rejection, where you said that the fact that the transactions do not meet some of the indicators would preclude the transactions being accounted for, the fact that the transactions do not meet some of the indicators would not preclude the transaction being accounted for as an aggregated item. I'm not sure whether that would change some people's practice, because I think some people do regard them having to meet all of them. So I think people, you know, if we're not going to rule on B6. I think we just need to say we need to look at it. People need to look at B6 and apply it without commenting on it.
John?
This is echo the comments. I mean, I'm not sure why we're discussing implementation guidance that doesn't form part of the standard, and I think we need to be careful in any agenda decision what we actually say about it that might be considered interpretive, because it is implementation guidance. It very much depends on the facts and circumstances. So, I mean, I agree with most of what's in the staff paper, that it depends on facts and circumstances. Maybe we should look to slim down the decision to pretty much say that. But I don't think it's appropriate to interpret guidance that does not form part of the standard.
So you're the second volunteer. Joanna?
Well, I don't want to be the third volunteer. Because I'm going to say exactly the same thing. But I think we've got to be very, very careful. We shouldn't be, as a matter of principle, interpreting implementation guidance, I don't think. Doesn't mean I don't agree with what's in the staff paper, but I think, again, what's actually in the agenda decision needs to be short and sharp, I would think.
Scott?
I was intrigued by Charlotte's comments. Maybe, why does this structure exist? I mean, was it... Was it an attempt to get credit default swap exposure without credit default swap accounting? Or was it something else?
It depends on the person. Some people will do it because they only have the ability to do repos, and that's the form which they trade at. They have the repo agreements in place. They want to get to the same economics as a CDS and a credit default swap, but they don't have the capability of doing that, of booking it, of entering into credit agreements, issue agreements with respect to lots of different reasons. Or the flip side is some people don't want to mark to market. They can get to non-mark to market by doing this structure and not treating it as derivative. So you look at the facts and circumstances for the individual entities involved and see why they are doing it. So B6, and that's it. It's the last characteristic that is the key. Why are they doing it?
Yeah, no, I was just interested. You said it was a common structure. That kind of surprised me. So I was kind of wondering, you know, maybe there is something other than accounting as to why this is common.
It can be regulated. Often people are driven by their local GAAP compared to IFRS and, you know, all the different combinations of that.
I sense that we were in agreement, number one, that we shouldn't do it. doesn't surprise me. And number two, that we should significantly slim down the agenda decision. I think I flagged Tony and John as drafting advisors. If you can work with Juan He, and then we'll circulate wording to you offline so that we can get it into IFRC update.
Okay.